Welcome to We Are Chafees Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of humanness, community, and well-being rooted in Chafee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today I'm talking with Jennifer Dempsey, founder of the Salida Circus and former director of the Belfast Community Circus in Northern Ireland. Both are social circuses. So naturally, we talk about what a social circus is and the good it serves in a community. We talk about what it was like for Jen to live in Belfast for 12 years, using the circus as a tool for bringing people together during the Troubles. She talks about how and why her experiences in Belfast were such an incredibly formative time in her life, and how she learned the value of creating opportunities for joy and absurdity in the midst of political turmoil, violence, and grief. We talk about how, as a two-time college dropout who also was, in her words, the world's worst waitress and a terrible employee for others, Jen figured out the unconventional path of her own life and not only has thrived, but has helped so many others along the way. We talk about solving life's quality problems, getting past our own self-consciousness, and developing our skills of humor to create resilience, among other things. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority. It's available on all podcast players, and the show also airs at 1 p.m. Tuesdays at KHEN 106.9 FM Community Radio in Salida. And look for the monthly We Are Chafee column in the Chafee County Times and the Mountain Mail. Show notes, including links and a full transcript of this and all Looking Upstream conversations, are available at wearechafee.org. You can support the podcast by following We Are Chafee Pod on Instagram and the We Are Chafee account on Instagram and Facebook. Now here we go. My conversation with Jennifer Dempsey. Well, Jen, let's start with the circus.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your life in that, how you got started, what you got started with in the circus, what drew you to it. There you go. A whole load of questions right out of the gate.
When I was 8 years old, in third grade, my PE teacher had an after-school circus club, and his name was Mr. Moyer. And so my brothers and sisters and I just went to his after-school circus club like other kids went to soccer or other kids went to basketball. That was my kind of after-school sport. And he was a very unique person. He had been bequeathed all the circus equipment, and he just opened his gym to all these local kids who wanted to learn how to ride unicycles or do tumbling or trapeze or whatever. And, you know, of course, at 8 years old, I totally took it for granted. You know, I thought this was just like what kids do. And now looking back, I think, wow, that was really a unique opportunity. And little did I know that was going to like lay the blueprint for my life.
Yeah, it's such a pivotal moment mm-hmm. to come into contact and so early with mm-hmm. something that would resonate so much with your life.
Well, it's interesting because I really lost it for a lot of years. And my personal journey was coming back to it at age 21. There's a real common habit of kids sort of dropping out of circus school. I see it all the time now when they hit like 12 or 13, you know, they're too cool for circus school. And I was too, you know. And so my high school years, I really didn't do anything circusy. Did a little bit of gymnastics, but it was only when I went to do a year abroad in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I was enrolled as an English literature student at Queen's University, and I was still like, ooh, I don't know, this is not quite sure. I don't think this is what I want to do. I don't really know. Pretty restless. School never was very easy for me to excel in academically. I love learning. I'll learn till the cows come home, but the actual like structure of school was hard. So I'm twice college dropout. I don't use that as an example for other people, but my journey was. So, you know, it took me two times dropping out of college to finally say like, okay, so there's a different path for me and I'm going to find it. And so my motto is never let school get in the way of your education. So when I was at Queens and I dropped out of school again, it was 1989, in the middle of the Troubles. I'm 21 years old, like, just like, I don't know what my path is. But then I discovered this little circus club, and it was just like my third grade circus club after school. And I was just like in it to win it. Man, I just like kept going there, and it was so familiar, and it brought back this like childhood joy. And what the Belfast Circus was, it used circus as a way to bring Catholic and Protestant kids together in a neutral, playful, safe environment. So of course that definitely appealed to me. And so it was not only like finding my own personal joy, but also stepping into a way of using the arts for a higher purpose, which was totally a revelation to me. And that, I don't know, that was my path, and I've stayed on it since 21.
What was your experience of being there during the Troubles as an American and somebody, you know, just playing from the outside?
Yeah.
And what was going on with that experience in Northern Ireland?
I could go in a lot of different directions. So as an American living there, as an American college student living there, I was pretty protected from it. You know, the Queen's University area is pretty removed from, like, the Troubles. But once I dropped out of the circus and I was on my own, I ended up living in West Belfast with another circus performer. And what my takeaway from living in West Belfast, because I ended up living there for 12 years, that there is great value in creating opportunities for fun and joy and absurdity and comedy and lightheartedness in the midst of political turmoil. Lots of people were focusing on the political turmoil and trying to find a solution to the political crisis there. Thank goodness for them. Then there were lots of other people who were creating moments of happiness and moments of joy and celebration. And thank goodness for them. And it takes both to create a healthy society or to resolve conflict. What I learned was because I eventually became director of the Belfast Circus, my job was to facilitate workshops, put on shows, bring people into this creative space, teach them skills, find out what skills they had, and then perform that for the wider community. And what I found value in was by creating a neutral space, all their outside identities were irrelevant. And to be in a space with other people in a completely level, neutral space is so transformative, because suddenly everybody's on the same level. So discovering that in Belfast, I was able to bring that back to America and hopefully replicate it here in Salida, which I think it has happened.
It's interesting how programs like that, and I'm thinking specifically in America with opposing gangs, for example, and being brought together for maybe its creative purposes, its community purposes. But when you are face to face with someone, you have to see and hear the human across from you, and they understand that about you. A bunch of these labels and barriers to identity, and in this case, with the Troubles, we're talking about violence in these politics, long-standing hard feelings, and it's amazing that there are tools like this that can be creative and can be social and community-oriented to help kind of dissolve some of those barriers and bring people back together.
So I often refer to the Belfast Circus as a subculture in Northern Ireland, because you had your two very, very strong identities in conflict with each other, with all that history and all the identity that people carried. Creating a circus ring or a circus environment, you need to be present. You cannot care if your trapeze partner is Catholic or Protestant. You just want them to keep you up above the ground. You just don't want them to drop you. So the relationships were based on completely new contexts. And sometimes it worked. And you know what? Sometimes it didn't. I worked in a boys' home for about 4 years. They were all like in the court system somehow or another. Funny as heck. I mean, it was so, they were the funniest kids I ever worked with. And some of them were able to crack open their identities a little bit. And they did get integrated into the bigger circus community. And some of them like carried on and did careers. And some of them just, you know, they didn't. And, you know, that's just the nature of introducing anything new. It's going to take a while, or it'll take hold on to some people and it won't on others.
You said you were there for 12 years.
Yeah.
Was that 12 years, did that end up ultimately spanning the end of the Troubles?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the Troubles just, yes, the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, you know, was the quote-unquote end of the war, the ceasefire and all that. So the official war was over. However, the Troubles sort of continue to this day, under maybe a different name or in a different vein. What's also interesting is when I lived there, there was very little, suicide rates were low. There were petty crime. I mean, they had that, but it wasn't as prevalent in other areas. The Troubles seemed to sort of dominate the social fabric, and it's very interesting how it gave a lot of people a sense of identity, a sense of purpose. There was a struggle. There was something external to them that kind of focused their attention. And then when that was over, sadly, suicide rates have just shot sky high. So that's a very interesting, like, social study.
You think because they don't have that to identify with anymore, so they no longer feel like they're part of a team. Oh, now I'm out here alone. Who am I with? Who am I not? What do I associate with?
All that you said.
Wow.
And I think that the lack of purpose and the lack of external organization of your energies, without that, you have a lot of personal answering to do and a lot of self-direction. When your attention has been consumed in that way, first of all, I think it's a jolt to your system that now I don't label myself as a freedom fighter or as a victim, or, you know, you have to re-identify yourself. Plus, people are carrying deep, deep wounds. One of the things about the Good Friday Agreement that I can't imagine, I'm going there next week, by the way, so this is all very present on my mind, but another group I worked with was called WAVE, Widows Against Violence, and it was WAVE Trauma Center, and it worked with anybody in the Troubles who'd been bereaved, Catholic, Protestant, police, civilian, anybody. And I started a circus program with those children. And my focus was so much on the circus that I would just get little glimpses of, like, okay, what? That this kid lost both parents and what? I mean, that aspect of it was always there, and I absorbed it as I could. A lot of the time when I was in Northern Ireland, I was focused on the happy, focused on the circus, and there was a lot of that. And oftentimes, I just forgot where I was. I was just being a circus director. And then other times, I was like, I could get, like, paralyzed with the tragedy of the place. Okay, but what I was getting at was, the Good Friday Agreement said anybody who'd been imprisoned for Troubles-related offenses were now out, could now be released. So now in Northern Ireland, the Troubles are over, but there's this, like, mix of people living together who perpetrated, were victims, were, you know, carried out atrocities, living next door to each other.
So there wasn't really a reconciliation sort of process officially for everybody to come back into the shared society and have to work through those traumas. And yeah, wow.
I've been away now for 20 years, and so I'm not exactly sure. I would imagine there was, you know, peace and reconciliation programs to speak of. But one of my friends that I worked with for a long time at WAVE, he lost his wife and father-in-law in a bomb. And I saw him on a documentary, and he said he was walking into a shopping mall, and he walked right into, he saw the bomber. And I mean, that's his normal day. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how do you, at least when the war was going on, there was like, there was a little bit of rhyme and reason. But now you're walking in to buy a new pair of shoes and you're like, oh, hello, you planted the bomb that killed my, so that's a weird, that's a new way, that's a whole new mess.
Yeah, yeah. When you dropped out of school, and you ended up in this circus life, I don't know that you had those intentions. Tell me, you know, how that maybe went, but what did you think you might be heading toward as you chose to stay in Belfast, not just come back home to the U.S.? And it's sounding like to me that this was kind of a fun, I don't want to say diversion.
So I'm going to Belfast, trying to get back into the academic life. You know, I went to UMass Amherst for about a year. I dropped out. I was really struggling with, I was a 21-year-old. I had my own inner struggles with depression and with finding an outlet that would work for me and to try to keep me moving in a forward direction. And so my attempt at going to Belfast was like, well, let's try this college thing again. When I found the circus, it met a huge need in me. It was like, I was like, oh, wow, this is happiness again. I forgot about this. I am not moving from this space. Like, I just remember, like, when your TV gets in tune with the antenna, you're like, hey, hold the antenna there. That's how I felt when I found the circus. I was like, okay, I've found my antenna happiness. I can't leave. And my parents were actually very happy for me that I had found the thing that was going to work for me. And it just took me a couple of college tries to get there. And I started out, I didn't make any money. But my happiness factor was the thing that I needed most.
Did your parents have expectations when you were going off to college? I mean, well, let's look beyond that. Did they have expectations of what your life was supposed to be? This perhaps conventional sort of go to college, get married, get a career, have kids, whatever all they thought.
Yeah.
And I don't want to put that on your parents. That's why I'm asking, though, because that is, as I'm sure you're aware, a very common structure a lot of us are given and we're told conform to it.
So I'm a parent now, so I get it. I get it that you want to see your child following some sort of path that's going to keep them safe and, you know, fulfill them.
Stable
and all that. But I think I had struggled with this like recurring depression for so many years that I think my parents were just very, very happy that I was happy. You're in the middle of Northern Ireland and you found this sense of purpose in the circus and it's fun for you. And I hear this in your voice. I see it in your face. Your joy is back. You're good, you know. And I have a lot of gratitude and understanding now for my parents. And I don't think I was an easy child to raise.
Why do you think that?
I was told that, especially by my mom, she said she just had to trust the universe with me. And she said things that gave me a lot of belief in myself at a time when I didn't have a lot of belief in myself. And she would say things like, I never have to worry about you, Jennifer, because I know that you'll figure it out. And I did. When you have to, you do. I think the best thing that happened to me was unlatching myself from this privileged, white, middle class upbringing that I was born into, but that didn't hook me into a sense of purpose or meaning. And apparently that's what I need more than anything, more than money or a big house. Ugh, all that stuff just makes me tired. But like, I need to be fed with a sense of purpose. And finding the Belfast Circus gave me that. And it brought me everything I needed, like even materialistically. Like I was living on, when I got offered the circus director position, I was like, yes. And then I was like, oh, do I get paid for that? and I was offered a £5,000 a year pound salary. And I was like, awesome, I am living the life. And I had a roof over my head, and I have 5,000, you know, 5,000 pounds a year is, you know, like, whatever. But I had everything I needed.
It's proof that you can continue.
Yeah.
Right? That there might be a path forward here.
Yes. And I was onto something. I was figuring it out as I went along, and it was unfolding each day, and it was so thrilling and so exciting. I hadn't a clue what I was doing most of the time, but each little step I was like, oh, okay, that's one more step on the path, you know. My mom said this. She goes, I can't imagine you as an adult, Jennifer. And
you were an adult when she said that to you?
I was approaching adult because all this happened in, you know, 21, 22. And she was just like, I can't imagine you as an adult. And I actually couldn't either. Because, like, growing up in Fairfax, Virginia, around D.C., I was like, oh, God, none of this, like, is for me. I don't see myself here either. It was kind of scary. And, you know, I am of Irish heritage, so part of my reasoning for wanting to go to Belfast was the Irish connection thing. And, honestly, part of it was like, oh, well, I wonder what life in a war is like. I mean, that was my thinking at 21 years old. And, you know, that was just my path. I now look back and I can connect the dots. But when I was younger and creating the dots, that was a thing. I mean, that was really a challenge.
I think it's difficult when we are raised with certain expectations, rules, the conventions, and we have the privileged opportunity of that being easier for us than for a lot of people.
Right.
To go counter to that raises a lot of questions for a lot of people, which then puts pressure on us, even if it's coming from their best interests of they just want that stability for us. They just want us to have the security and to have the life that they value.
Mm-hmm.
It can be difficult to be alone in that, I think.
It was. And however, the community I found in Belfast, like in the circus, but also in the wider society of Belfast, it felt so enriching to me and so validating for me. And I think a lot of that is because I'm a creative person. And to be creative, you need a lot of, like, time and space where you're just, like, not sure what you're doing, but things are starting to make sense, but they're very nebulous. You can't, you know, now I'm okay with that kind of, like, that I don't know, but something's brewing, but I can't quite put my finger on it. I know that part of the creative process now. Younger, I was just like, oh, my God, like, I am having, like, the biggest existential crisis every day. This is, like, no fun. Going to Belfast just, it sounds melodramatic, but it's true. It really did save my life, and it turned me around. And I was around creative people. Plus, it's a very artistic, appreciative society. They appreciate the arts there. Arts are an important part of that society. Where I was growing up, they really weren't. In Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., they weren't that valued. It was just, or you got to be the best, you know, you better be the best actress or the best, you know, blah, blah, blah. You got to make a big career. And I was just like, oh, that's exhausting. And I'm not that confident. And what appealed to me in Belfast is the arts were serving a greater purpose. They were healing. The arts were a healing aspect of bringing people together. And that was so lovely because then anything I had to offer felt like it was being helpful. And it wasn't about me and my, you know, career path or my profile on IBDM or whatever that's called, that film thing. It wasn't,
right, right.
It wasn't about me. It was about serving the greater societal needs.
It's not seen in that conventional sense of ambition.
Right.
Because even if you had ideas for where you might have wanted your life to go, which sounds like might not have entirely been the case, because how can we draw that out when we are of such, I guess, an unconventional community, right? But even so, that's not necessarily how the conventions view it as ambition. It's just, well, your mom's saying, I can't imagine you as an adult, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned community, and I sometimes ask guests about their sense of community, especially when it pertains to them having had different life experiences, like what you're talking about with fellow circus performers and creative people. This is a different kind of sense of community, I think. Could you speak to that some?
I can, because what I realize my job has been all these years is to give people permission. Like the one consistent thing I've done since I moved to Salida is created a space to give people permission to try these new things and to like validate them for trying. Like, it's important that you're here trying this tumbling class at age 42. That's awesome. That is awesome. And don't let anybody make you think otherwise. That is what I think the most important thing you can give another creative person is to validate their that thing in them they may not even be able to name, but to let's like foster it a little bit and like tell me more about that and oh try this or try that, and it eventually shapes something. And it's a mystery, you know, this whole creative process. And the way I've come to understand it now at 56 is that it's a you know, creative energy flows through you, and my job is to like let it flow through me so it can flow through other people. And then something is going to happen. There'll be a dynamic created between people, and then we will mold that and we'll shape that. And then, oh, it's called a show now. Or, oh, it's called a discussion. Or, you know, it takes different shapes, but there has to be a little bit of managing the shape and allowing the shape to manage itself, to find itself. And so I just feel like my job is to give permission to people to be in that space of kind of trying to figure it out.
A lot of people, I think, find it very difficult to give themselves permission, and they don't feel like they have it from whether it's family, friends, and especially as we get older.
Right.
The longer we age, the more we feel like we are supposed to sustain a certain role. Mm-hmm. So you giving permission, and to people who are well past the 8 years old when you got your start, I think is incredible. And I'm wondering if that is a key component of what we mean by social circus as it pertains to here versus your initial experience many years ago in Belfast. Or how would you describe what social circus means in rural central Colorado and how you bring people together?
To explain it to people in the simplest form, I say social circus uses circus training as a social work tool. So that's a real broad general thing, but people get to kind of understand that terms. So with kids, we open it to everybody. We open our workshops to everybody. But we really reach out to maybe at-risk kids or kids who might need a little bit more sense of inclusion or whatever. And it's all about promoting this, like, social, emotional, physical health for its own sake. What happens is if you hold enough of those workshops, people get really skilled and good at this, at the unicycle or trapeze or juggling or whatever. So we have a employment side of it where people actually go out and get work as a professional circus performer. But that's not the main goal. But that has just happened, which is great. People, you know, can come to Salida, train up, and actually get work as a circus performer.
Like you. I mean, you were introduced to it when you were really young, and ultimately you would have this life that is so entwined with circus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, I knew what to do when I came here because I'd had those years in Belfast, and I watched how it went from this fledgling little grassroots organization, and each step of the way, it got more and more solidified with more people joining, the mission, money getting pumped into the organization, people getting, like, paid to be an administrator now, which meant they had to do all the boring work, let them. but it built itself up. And now, next year is its 40th anniversary, and it's this, like, international training school, and people come train there, and the people go all over the world from there. So I watched how that was sort of built up along the way, and I was part of building it up, too. So when I moved to Salida, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with it when I grew up, I was 39, and I gave myself permission to, like, run away from the circus if I needed to. But after about a week, I started workshops in my backyard. So it was all just local neighborhood kids coming in, tumbling, juggling, whatever, just for fun. And it was just like, oh, yeah, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then every little increments, it got more and more solid and you know, and people, adults in Salida were like, I know how to juggle. I was a clown in high school. I was on the gymnastics team. Great. Oh, really? You can teach a back handspring? You can teach a clowning routine? Awesome. So wherever you go, there are going to be resources there. One of my projects is called Build Your Own Big Top. I'm going to go speak about it in Pueblo at the Colorado Creative Summit next month. And it's to show that anywhere you can start a circus. If you have a pair of socks, you can start a circus. You ball up your socks and then you start juggling. That's it. It will gather momentum and allow it to gather momentum. This is what I did with Salida Circus. I had no business plan. I had no nothing. The only thing I knew I wanted to do when I moved here was, like, make my own living doing what I wanted to do, and it was, like, still stilt walking and acrobatics and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, how do I get a job? And I joined a couple of, like, fair associations, and then I had these two kids in my life who are my kids, and they were 11 and 13, and they joined the circus, and we became family, and so we started going on the road together as this little trio, and we were the Salida Circus. And our first gig was at the Lamar County Fair, and it was myself and Destiny and CJ, and we did stilts and acrobatics, and we got paid, and so I could pay my rent and feed them, and we were good to go. And so it's just built up very, very organically. And as I always say to people, I never set out, I don't need to have, like, the biggest, baddest circus in the world. I just wanted to do what I knew I could offer, and I wanted to do it in a way that was manageable and not admin heavy. That's also been, like, an interesting journey as, like, a business owner, because I'm, like, accidentally successful because, I've kept wanting to do it. I haven't burnt out yet. I've had little moments here and there, but, you know, it's, I want to stay in the joy of it. And the business structure of it has found its way from people in the community. I have to say, Salida Circus was built on social capital. People have, like, made this thing happen. I've just kept doing what I wanted to do, and people have kind of shaped it financially around, you know, and helped me figure out how to do that, too. So, I don't know. That's my business style. And I realize it's not for everybody, but it's what I did.
It seems to work for you.
It works,
right?
For me.
This is how life has gone for you. Is to follow what? Your heart. I mean, to use a phrase, it's you being willing to somehow tap into, I don't know if this is intuition or how would you describe what it is that you are listening to when you have made life decisions, when you have followed what becomes a path.
I'm very inflexible on some level. I am of the temperament where, like, I am the world's worst waitress. I've been fired so many times. I'm, like, a terrible employee for other people. I am. I don't mean to be, but I am. And it's because I have too many of my own ideas and too much inspiration to do my own thing. So being wired the way that I am, I had to figure it out. I totally had to figure it out. And I'm still figuring it out, but I trust the process now because, you know, here I am. But I remember my dad, poor dad. But he said, Jennifer, there's a word for you, serendipity. And I don't know, there is.
That's a positive word to me.
It's a positive word, yeah. But I think both my parents just had to stand back and let me fly. And if I was going to crash, I was going to crash.
I think we have to be open to serendipity.
Yeah.
And if we go where we think we have to have this such a structured, conventional path, we're not really being open to what the possibilities are, I think, as they come in. If we think we have to live to a certain way of being or climb a ladder of a particular kind, then how much are we actually allowing? Again, I'll use the word intuition because mm-hmm. that's one that resonates for me, I guess, is to hear that internal something that says this is the next step.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And doing that enough times, trusting your intuition, it gets easier and easier. So now I say, I don't get ideas. I get assignments. They strike me like assignments. There's like no question that I'm going to like follow this through.
And you can trust it because you've had the experience
right.
of trusting it.
Exactly. So now when I'm in the middle of organizing this Women's Day show, and you know, we have probably like 25 people in it or whatever. And you know, I'm talking about it and encouraging them, oh, that's a great act and blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking like, the show will go on one way or the other. I don't know what it's going to look like. I also am going to accept whatever it is because it's all going to be in the process of learning or contributing or being open and being like offering something to the public in a way that is generous. And this is a big thing too. I tell my performers or actors or whatever, I say, if you're self-conscious, you're focusing on the wrong thing. It isn't about you. You are the tool for this bigger show. Think about the bigger show and the what you are serving. That was very freeing for me when I was younger and self-conscious. Everybody is when they start out. But to then all of a sudden shift the focus from it being about me to it being about what am I serving the audience here? Oh man, then it like just flows through you and it's so fun. And you know, when I perform now, everybody's my friend. I just make everybody who's come to that show my friend, whether they know it or not.
Well, I think that has factored into your parenting and the way that you operate your life and within that community, right? Mm-hmm. You've mentioned to me before that is something you teach your son, mm-hmm. is everybody is our friend. And a very positive, actually, you've described it as wonderfully naive.
Yeah, I am. I am. I am wonderfully naive. I've been kind of made fun of for that. And that's okay. That's all right. That's all right.
By the cynical?
By the smart. And
the ones who know how life works and that you can't possibly just be joy-filled and positive.
Yeah. And, you know, the ones who know better. Okay. You know what you know. That's fine. I appreciate that. And I am glad that there's rails of safety, you know, in the world and stuff like that. And, you know, it's constantly a learning curve, this, like, idea that everybody's my friend. But I'm going to start out with that until they prove otherwise.
I think, you know, we're living in a tough time for that. Because of the divisions and things, I won't try to compare them to the troubles that you had, you know, experience and knowledge of those years ago. But while you were talking about that, plenty resonates as well, because what we're talking about are people who've chosen a team.
Yeah.
They've chosen an identity. They're mm-hmm. rooted into that, and then they're lashing out because of it. And then you have this wonderful naivete and this positive light and energy, and then what you were bringing to the community because of it, and teaching kids. Mm-hmm. There's so much positive in that that I think it's very admirable. Rather than sitting in a dim lit room at home, feeling all anxious and uptight and afraid of everything and everyone.
One of the skills I learned along the way too was humor, and it's a learnable skill, which I didn't know either. And what the ultimate skill of humor is a new perspective, adopting a new perspective on a situation. And this is how the situation is. These are the facts. And everybody has a choice of how to respond to the facts. And to develop that choice is where you develop a sense of humor. And humor is a great way to rebel and to like go, you know what? I don't really accept that that's the only way to look at this problem or this situation. So I'm actually, like, I don't want to say teaching, but I'm facilitating a humor workshop in April to share with others what I learned and how freeing it was. And everybody has their own route into their own funny bone if they choose to find it. And that's what I want to help people do. Because we're all hung up on stuff. It's part of being human. We all over-identify with things and get fixated on things. And we get neurotic or we get upset or we get stuck. And humor gets us unstuck because it casts this new possible light on a situation or create a new response to that. And boy, oh boy, I learned that in Belfast, the black humor, as they call it, or dark humor. I was like, wait a minute, I want to be funny like everybody here, but I'm not funny.
You're talking about teaching, well, maybe awareness of mm-hmm. humor. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what you're describing also is from a performative place. But I'm also thinking about how we take ourselves individually too seriously. Mm-hmm. And we would all probably do better, or a lot of us would, to develop a sense of humor about ourselves and about kind of what we decide is right and so serious.
Well, the way I look at humor is it's an emotional skill to develop, just like any muscle. You can develop your muscle of humor. And what that will give you is like resiliency to the world. And I really saw this a lot in Belfast, that the humor in Belfast was so profound to me. And it was like a defense mechanism that allowed people to carry on, and the whole physiology thing about laughter, I mean, I could go into that too, but it was just that I was like, whoa, this is like an important life skill. I'm not quite sure what this is, but I remember thinking that to myself, like, if nothing else, I want to like learn about humor, because people here are surviving life. And one of the things I realized now growing up in Fairfax, Virginia, was my problems were not quality. I didn't have quality problems growing up.
What do you mean by that, quality problems?
My problems growing up were very unnecessary. I don't say that in judgment. I say that as like a fact, because human beings need problems to work on. We're wired to solve problems. If you don't have a quality problem, you're going to find another problem. So it could be like, oh my God, like I don't like the size of my butt. That's going to become my problem to solve. Okay, how petty and how unimportant is that? You know, be healthy, but like that can become a fixation.
So quality as in terms of significance,
yes,
of the problem, the real weight of a problem.
And a problem I have come to understand is a problem. I would like my problem solving to be about helping other people. So it's not about me and my vanity. It's about I wonder how I could use the circus to create a fundraiser for South Sudanese girls. Like, to me, that's like a quality problem. And I'm privileged enough to be able to have all my needs met that I can think about something like that. In Belfast, what I found was people were literally surviving, literally, like, it was like life and death. And there was a lot of poverty there, so it was literally like getting food on the table and stuff like that. So they were grounded. Frank McCourt, this Irish writer, yeah. He said his dreams were never neurotic. They were always simply to get out of his poverty in the lane where he grew up. So it was very grounding. He didn't have ADD. He didn't have a zillion distractions. And that's always stuck with me. Like, he didn't have neurotic problems. He had quality problems. And I think that's this lack of quality problem can be endemic in affluent societies. I've done it. I mean, I speak from experience. I get focused on the wrong things. And there was no joy in that. And once, for me, it was when I went to Belfast and suddenly all my skills and my fun with the circus had a place to go to help others. And that was such a sense of joy and purpose and motivation. And like, I'm so grateful that I found that place. Like, it just worked for me.
It was at an age for you that was, I mean, in your 20s, largely, and I'll describe it, I guess, as coming of age.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if that's really the age that we talk about when we use that phrase, but when we think about being an adult and coming up and really shaping worldviews, experiences, all these things that you carry forward as you, you know, develop and evolve as an adult and a human being, so much happened there for you that was so important.
So I say I was raised in Fairfax, but I grew up in Belfast. That's what happened to me. I really came of age in Belfast. And by the time I moved back to America, I was like 33 or something, 34. And I told myself I was moving back like an Irish immigrant. I needed to hold on to all those things that I learned and just come back to America as an Irish person.
Do you reflect on those experiences yourself? Not for a conversation like this, where obviously we're digging into that, but is that a period of time in your life that just frequently comes to your mind and you think of the lessons that you learned then?
Always. And, yeah. Always. It informs my whole life. It informs how I keep my house. It informs how I raise my kid. It informs everything. And there's two phrases that I live by that I got in Belfast. One is thrive on neglect. I saw people there, especially kids, thriving on neglect. That made them resilient, funny. They had a strength about them. Like, God, I remember this little four-year-old in the neighborhood I lived in, and I was like, okay, like, someday I want to grow up and be like him. He was so streetwise and all that. And I realize that's like, I'm looking at it from a real, you know, wonderfully naive perspective. But he did have something I wanted, and it was like a resiliency to life. So that thrive on neglect, I keep in the back of my mind. And also throw another spud in the pot. Because living in Belfast, where seven people were living in a two-bedroom house or whatever, there was always enough, and there was always enough for you if you happened to walk in. That open door, welcoming, there's always room, there's always enough. First of all, my parents were like that. You know, there were five kids, but we always had other people like coming and staying, or, you know, the cleaner ended up like, you know, camping out in the basement or whatever. So I was raised in that environment. And then I was definitely around that environment in Belfast where it wasn't an affluent society. Oh, and here's another thing I live by. The people who have the least are the first to give. I have seen that over and over and over.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It's amazing. And I think two reasons, that's why, because they know what it's like not to have any. So they're going to empathize more with that. A little goes a long way. And there's a leveling. There's this thing, the whole thing about money, the more you have, the more you need. It's a spiral that never ends, and it's such a sickness. Yeah. And there's this optimum amount of money that will allow you to meet your needs, be comfortable, and also be in the flow of give and take. I have found people who have the most money are the ones who protect it the most, and then suddenly right. their life becomes about protecting their money. And it's yep. like, I want to shake them and go, you've lost perspective. Like, give it away. You will be so much freer if you give your money away.
Yeah, that fear-based scarcity mindset, despite how much abundance they actually totally. Have. And then people who, like we were talking about with how you have learned, you can take leaps and you will land and you will survive and even thrive. And I think, for better and worse, people who have lived through such neglect, such challenging times and experiences, I think that they probably have also learned we can make it through. We can survive this. I don't know what's going to come tomorrow and make that work, but we can do it.
I think it could go two ways. I think I've seen it, and I see it in myself, but I see it in other people where if they have experienced a lack in the past, they can become greedier mm-hmm. and more self-protective, or the majority of people I know are like, oh yeah, I know it'll be fine. Here, have some of this. I know I'll be fine. So I think yeah. it can go either way, and I really love being around the people who have gotten through something or experienced something and come out the other end, and it's made them more generous and more loving and more connecting and more open. And that's also what I'm really motivated by, is to create opportunities for that cracking open to happen. And just even if it's a little micro move towards opening. And I'll end on this if you want. So with clowning, humor and clowning, they're very closely related. And clown to me is a verb. You can clown anything, and anybody can clown themselves. And it's really all it is in the most simple definition is bringing out the things about you that you're embarrassed of and celebrating them and walk around in them and have people applaud them. And guess what? You're not the worst person in the world. And you know what? Somebody else in the room is going to have the same hang up you do. So why not get on stage and like celebrate it? So that's clowning. Big deal about your hang up. Somebody else has it in the world, and don't let it stop you from connecting with other people.
Well, Jen, it's been great to talk with you. I appreciate your insights and getting to hear more about this experience in Belfast, because I've definitely been curious. This has been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I want to just plug this because I think it's an interesting... I think Nathan Ward did a great job. He made a documentary about the circus called Come One, Come All, and it's on PBS.
Okay.
Come One, Come All, Salida Circus with a Purpose. And I think Nathan Ward of Grit and Thistle Film Company captured what we're trying to do with Salida Circus.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast. If our conversation here today sparked curiosity for you, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechafee.org. If you have comments or know someone in Chafee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email us at info@wearechafee.org. We invite you to rate and review the We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use with that functionality. We also invite you to tell others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado, to Heather Gorby for graphic and web design, to Andrea Carlstrom, Director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, Community Advocacy Coordinator for the We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. The We Are Chafee Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chafee County Department of Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and it's supported by the Colorado Public Health and Environment Office of Health Disparities. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast and related storytelling initiatives at wearechafee.org and on Instagram and Facebook at wearechafee. Lastly, until the next episode, as we say here at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.